I never meant to cause you any sorrow.
720 WGN. It's Amy Guth in for John Williams with you till 3 o'clock today. That, of course, that audio, I almost want to sit there and listen to it a minute, kind of gave me chills. That was when Prince played the Super Bowl halftime show.
Singing Purple Rain in the rain.
I might start crying right now hearing Prince. What a loss. I still, like, Prince and David Bowie still, like, don't feel real to me because I don't want them to feel real.
I know.
But the Super Bowl is upon us. Oh, my gosh. I can't believe it. I don't even want to talk about January. Way too fast. Yet felt like a year at the same time.
I know. Well, you don't find yourself, like, lamenting, oh, I missed out on more January.
We should be
happy that it went by fast. But it's true. It does feel weird.
I saw somebody post something like, all right, it's February 1st. January was the longest year I've ever seen, or something like that. That was very true.
That's everything now.
It's the nature of things. A lot of information coming out of us, coming at us rather. There is a wonderful, wonderful list that Rolling Stone put out about Super Bowl halftime shows that ranked worst to best. I think is very, very funny. That made me laugh because mostly because the first two things on it, they're saying the worst is the Black Eyed Peas from 2011.
Right.
Which I remember that one.
I do.
I don't remember it being that bad, but I remember being good. But I remember being, there were issues.
I looked through this list too, and I was kind of feeling like they all blend together a little bit in my head because they do all have they work in a similar way, even though some are much better than others. They're all kind of the same thing.
Yeah, it's like sing, pyrotechnics, sing, flashy lights, sing.
Right, but if you do go back and watch, so I was like, I'm sure this one's like not great, but maybe it's not that bad. And then I was, you just get swept up in the fact that it's live, but when you go back to rewatch, you're like, oh, it felt very leaden and slow, like weirdly like slow. They're playing I Got a Feeling was their big hit at that time.
That's right.
It was relatively new and but also huge, so it made sense to sort of structure a halftime show around that song because everybody likes that song.
That song was the one that, do you remember when Oprah took over Michigan Avenue and there was like a flash mob and a live show right at the Michigan Avenue Bridge? That was the song that like the flash mob broke out. I was standing in the Tribune Tower looking down from like the fifth or sixth floor, so
it's a flash mob anthem for sure.
Flash mob anthem.
It was engineered to play at every wedding and bar mitzvah and whatever else.
Absolutely.
For the rest of time. And, God bless them. But yeah, not a great. They don't dance, and they don't really sing.
And
at that point, they weren't doing much rapping either, to be honest. So
You here for?
Fergie was singing, but she didn't sound great, to be honest. And so the whole thing was just like, it was weirdly boring.
The other thing I think that stands out
might have earned its title is the worst. I don't know. There's a lot of bad ones.
The thing, many things made me laugh about this list, but number two on the list, and again, ranked from worst to best, Black Eyed Peas being worse, right after that is everything from 1967 to 1989, which is funny.
Well, because if I understand correctly, that was before they really started like booking high-profile artists perform.
It wasn't a thing.
It was like marching bands and whatever. I don't know. Some other stuff. I'd actually be curious to see some of those. But
I know. I would, too. Like, that doesn't sound like the worst thing.
It sounds okay.
It doesn't always have to be A-list.
I think it'd be fine, yeah.
Honestly, you got to flip over to Puppy Bowl at that point anyway. You know what I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah. Oh, do you have plans to watch the Puppy Bowl tomorrow?
Well, I mean,
it's good in like 20-second
increments.
That's
right. I'm not going to stare at it the whole day.
There have been times where I was like, let's settle in and watch the Puppy Bowl. And as someone who loves puppies, I realized like, there's actually not much programming happening here.
Oh, it's just puppies being adorable.
But it's good just, to step in for a second and then move on.
There is an Illinois dog competing in the Puppy Bowl this year.
Oh, really? Competing?
Yeah, compete. I don't know how you win.
What's their name?
I don't remember the dog's name, but I remember seeing that like somebody I know posted something on Facebook that like there's this dog from Illinois and he was, I guess, an adopted shelter dog. So he's, everybody's rallying around the local.
I hope they win.
Yeah, I don't know how you win. I think you don't use the field as a potty.
There's one way to lose. And it's to
that's
poop
all you
on
do.
TV.
I mean, that's a good rule for life, right? don't poop on TV. That's a pretty good rule.
No, probably not.
And then there's the kitten halftime show that's very, very cute.
Oh, okay.
There's a lot of conflicting programming tomorrow, see? I want to watch all these things.
There's the Super Bowl, and then there's everything else for everyone who doesn't want to watch it.
Okay, here's the other thing that stands out, though, about the list of Super Bowl programming ranked worst to best.
Right.
You forget about how weird the mashups are, because sometimes you're like, oh, mm-hmm. it's so-and-so, and then someone else walks out, you're like, oh, okay, cool. But when you look back at it and just kind of read the list, you're like, I never would have... For example,
right.
I'm going to say Shania Twain, Sting, and No Doubt in 2003.
Shania Twain, Sting, and No Doubt.
Three things that don't match.
No, I guess that's what they were going for, right? With these mashups, it's like, how can we appeal to the broadest base? You know, cover a lot of ground.
That's one way to do it.
But it sometimes makes for a disparate sort of show.
Oh, sure.
I would like to rewatch that. I was going through it like, I could watch all these right now. Why not? But... I did notice that in the top 10, with I think one or maybe two exceptions, it was mostly just one artist performing.
Yeah.
Like, those are the ones they deemed the most successful.
Sure.
Because those mashups can be really fun. I think there was one with like Aerosmith and NSYNC, Nelly.
Britney Spears and Mary J.
So that's a lot.
That's a lot.
That's a lot happening in 12 minutes.
Yeah,
and
that's a lot.
That was like number four. They put that pretty high.
Yeah, that was number four.
But it's a high degree of difficulty. It's easier if you just give someone with a big catalog free reign to kind of do their thing.
Which takes us back to the Prince song we were playing.
Although they still, even for those, bring in other artists, usually not for Prince. I always thought Prince was like the consensus pick for obviously the best.
I've always heard people refer to Prince and Beyonce as being the leaders, according to this list, they got U2.
Oh yeah, I was gonna do a tease, but because I do want to come back to this maybe later in the show, where people can text in and give us what their favorite was, or something.
I would also like to know who would be just the dream mashup.
Right.
You know, I think
personal...
that would be. Yeah, who would be like the best Super Bowl halftime show mashup? Let's say at least three.
If fame and like broad appeal was no object,
yeah.
Or.
It'd be somebody
if it didn't
really
actually
obscure
have to. Yeah.
With.
Well,
like,
maybe.
With like, I don't know. And let's say living or dead.
Right. Okay.
Okay. You have to pick at least three. Text us 312-981-7200.
And we'll give ours by the end of the show.
And we'll give ours because it's going to take some time. Especially you. You like know all the obscure music.
That's not true.
I get half of my music listening from you. That's a
that's
thing.
That's sad. I'm sorry, but that's not.
All right. Well,
we need to work on that.
We're going to take a break. We have a big show today. We have a lot of guests coming in to share their knowledge. We're all going to learn great things from them. Back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. 720 WGN, it's Amy Guth. Thanks for being with me today. I'm in for John Williams today, with you till 3 o'clock. So I'm sure you all heard about how just this past week, Governor Pritzker, in the State of the State address, he really doubled down on renewable energy, saying that it was a priority for Illinois. And he said it's time to put consumers and climate first. He was, of course, talking about the Clean Energy Jobs Act, which, if passed, would put Illinois on the path to 100% renewable energy by 2050. That's a lot, right? That's a lot. And it's kind of a lot to think about of, you know, how do we get from point A to point B? How do we do that? What does that look like? What's it going to cost? All that good stuff. So we're joined now by Ty Benefil, who is the co-founder of Hero Power, to talk with us about that. Hi, Ty. Welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us today.
Hi, Amy. Thank you so much for having me.
Glad you could take time out of your Saturday to talk with us. Okay, so from your perspective, you're working in this clean energy space. Tell us a bit about your company and how it came to be and how it fits into all of this conversation.
Sure. So Hero Power is a 100% renewable electricity supplier in Chicago, or in Illinois. We've made it possible for any person or business in Chicago or the surrounding suburbs to switch or to support renewable electricity every time they pay their electricity bill. So there's no equipment to change or anything like that. We just go and buy renewable energy certificates from a wind farm that matches 100% of our customers' energy consumption. It's a very easy and effective way to support renewable energy, which is definitely what, you know, our state and the country and the world needs right now.
And so you have said that you feel like Illinois is poised to really be a leader in the U.S. around renewable energy. Why Illinois in particular?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think as you've seen at the federal level, the United States has really lost its position as a leader when it comes to clean energy and combating climate change. We pulled out of the Paris agreements. You know, we've done a lot to hurt our, you know, our leadership standing in the world. So it's so important that states and cities take on this challenge at a local level. And as you can see by the, you know, by Governor Pritzker's comments earlier this week, this is important, and this is going to be a part of his 2020, you know, legislation goals. So I think we are poised as a state, because we've got a lot of land where we can install wind turbines and take advantage of the, you know, the natural wind that flows over Illinois. We've got a lot of people here in the state that are already working in renewable energy, and the Clean Energy Jobs Act is just going to do so much more to promote clean energy. So it's great to see that, you know, Illinois is taking a leadership position, filling the void that we, you know, that's left by the federal level.
And then talk to me a bit, if you would, about the HEAT Act, which went into effect on January 1st.
Yeah, you know, the HEAT Act was long overdue. Unfortunately, the retail electricity industry has been occupied by some bad actors really since its inception. And these energy companies had business models that were basically, you know, sign customers up at a low rate and then really increase their price when the customers aren't looking. It left customers leery of the industry, and for a good reason. But the HEAT Act should eliminate some of these bad practices. And the HEAT Act requires greater transparency in pricing, not only their own, but, you know, the energy company's price, but also stating the utility's price to compare. That's one of the things at Hero Power that we felt was really important, was to always charge the same rate as the utility, which is, you know, the ComEd basic electricity rate is indexed to our rate, so it's always the same. Another thing the HEAT Act does, it eliminates termination fees. So many times customers were, you know, stuck in bad contracts, and they were penalized if they left those contracts. So the HEAT Act got rid of that. It also got rid of some predatory marketing and sales practices, especially in communities, low-income communities or elderly communities that were often taken advantage of by these retail electricity providers. So, you know, it was our goal when we started Hero Power to really fight back against these practices that these retail energy companies have gotten away with for so long, and to be an electricity supplier that brings trust back to our, you know, to the industry and to the customers, really, because we feel like there is value in retail electricity as long as, you know, these suppliers can create value for customers. And that's what, you know, we stand to do with Hero Power.
Yeah, I've been watching, you know, conversation around the HEAT Act for quite a while and the issues surrounding it with a lot of interest. Just from the consumer protection piece of that, this is essentially one of the strongest consumer protection laws in the country around certain aspects of this. And as it's been very widely noted, I know, as I've talked about before, this kind of thing that you describe, this kind of predatory practice around a lot of energy, has this has cost hundreds of millions for consumers just in these kind of fees. So it's a very serious issue. I mean, I think a lot, it's got its own complexities to it. So I think sometimes it could get glossed over, but I think it's an important one. I'm glad you were able to speak to that with us. So tell me a bit more about how you came to found Hero Power. I think your own origin story seems to have a little bit of that in there too, about kind of getting around and retaliating against, I guess is the word, around some of these predatory companies.
Exactly, yes. So my co-founder and I actually started our first company, which is Meter Genius, while we were at Northwestern about 7 years ago. And that company's goal was we built web and mobile apps that helped energy companies help their customers save energy. So we helped them lower their energy consumption. And we actually sold those products to these retail electricity suppliers. So they were our clients, and that was really our foray into the retail energy industry, because our clients were using these apps that we built. And we found, you know, that the end users, the customers, they loved these apps, but they often had problems with their electricity suppliers, doing what I had said earlier as far as increasing their rates. And actually, my own co-founder was a victim of one of these retail electricity suppliers' bad practices, and was actually awarded a settlement of over $780 as part of a class action settlement against one of these retail electricity suppliers there in Illinois. So we said, you know, what we're going to do, we're going to stop, you know, helping these retail electricity suppliers, because we didn't feel like, you know, they were really there for their customers and creating value for their customers. So we said, we're going to start our own retail electricity supplier, only sell renewable energy backed electricity, and make sure that, you know, from the every piece of marketing, every time that we, you know, interact with our customer, it's a great experience, because that's what, you know, Illinois customers deserve. So we've got, you know, we've got a great web and mobile app that helps customers use less electricity, and we only sell 100% renewable energy certificate backed energy. So we're very proud of the product that we've created, and we think that finally there's an alternative to some of these bad actors in Illinois' retail electricity industry.
And where can people go to find out more about your company and learn more about what you do?
Yeah, they can go to our website, which is myheropower.com.
Wonderful. And I'm sure you're on social media and all that good stuff, too. But maybe start at the website. And if you follow me on Twitter, I will be sure and tweet out links to that after the program. And we just have a couple of minutes left. But I also want to mention you are the host of the podcast, The Climate Pod, which looks at weekly news around these kind of issues beyond just power, but environmental and all that. Tell us about that, if you would.
Yeah, of course. So I'm lucky enough to be the co-host of The Climate Pod. Every week, we talk to the leading activists, academics, journalists on the most relevant climate and environmental news. So we've had guests from NASA, from the New York Times, from the United Nations, really some of the most, you know, the most important voices when it comes to climate change on our podcast. And we get to hear the great stories of the work that people are doing to combat climate change. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of pretty somber news out there when it comes to climate change. We definitely cover that. But we also want to make it, you know, easily accessible to people who are not climate experts. So we've also had guests on from Netflix, from HBO, from comedians, all sorts of comedians, because look, climate change affects people in all sorts of ways, and there's a lot of people that are doing some great things to spread the word and to get the message out there on how we can better combat climate change and preserve our environment and our world for generations to come, and we're really lucky to get those guests on the Climate Pod every week.
Where can people go to find that podcast?
Yeah, The Climate Pod is on all of your favorite podcasting platforms. So we're on iTunes, we're on Stitcher, we're on Spotify. You can also follow us on social media. Our Twitter is at The Climate Pod or at Climate Pod. We're very excited to be growing the podcast, and we've got quite the audience now.
Great. Well, thanks so much. I really appreciate you taking time to talk with us a little bit about this today. Again, for those of you who follow me on Twitter, I'm going to tweet out links to all the stuff we just mentioned so you can find it for yourself. But head to myheropower.com to find out about the company. Ty Benefil, thanks so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you, Amy.
All right, we're going to take a little break. Back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. All right, 720 WGN, Amy Guth in for John Williams today with you until 3 o'clock. Lots to do on the program today. We've got a ton of guests. And right now we're joined by Ali Marati, a business reporter at the Chicago Tribune. It has been a minute, Ali. Thanks so much for being with us. Haven't talked to you in a while.
I know. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, you wrote recently about a class action lawsuit around Facebook. I read this story with a lot of interest. I think there's a lot of conversations to be had around data privacy. And I've always watched, you know, European courts seem to be taking it a much different way than American courts. But this is a really interesting step. So catch us up if you would.
Yeah, for sure. So I think one of the things to know first and foremost is that in Illinois, we have one of the strictest laws in the nation protecting our biometric information, which is basically your fingerprints, an iris scan, a face scan. So thinking about like facial recognition and that kind of stuff, it sounds kind of like James Bondy when I say iris scan and like fingerprint scan and stuff. But, you know, there are a lot of employers that take fingerprint scans. It's kind of like a timing sheet type of thing. So the district law here, Illinois, has kind of become a hotbed for legal activity around these things. And in 2015, there was a lawsuit that started here involving Facebook and their facial tagging feature. If you remember back a few years ago when you would upload a photo to Facebook, that like box would pop around a face and say, is this Amy Goose, you know? Some plaintiffs sued saying that Facebook was violating that strict law we have here in Illinois.
That's so interesting. And I remember that pop-up, and I used to always get mad at it because it would think I was somebody else. It would always suggest that my face was like some dude with a beard or something. I was like, excuse me, I am not that dude that looks like a lumberjack right now.
Really, really insulting or real complimentary.
Right. I was like, oh, I wish I was that person, or I'm sorry, I'm definitely not that person or whatever. It was always very funny. It was always like way off anyway. But as a result of this, I mean, I think this is interesting. I want to come back to Illinois with some of our tougher and stricter biometrics laws. I want to come back to that. But on this, what is the latest? I mean, this settlement sounds really interesting. What is that going to mean for consumers?
Yeah, so basically the lawsuit has been playing out for almost 5 years in court, and it got moved to California, and Facebook kept appealing, and they tried to get the Supreme Court to take it up. And eventually they decided to just do the settlement. It's $550 million, and all that is going to Illinois Facebook users. So the attorneys tell me it could be 5 or 6 million people, and there's no steps anybody can take yet to be a part of the settlement. That's going to come later down the line. They have to do some court proceedings, but it could eventually mean, you know, a couple hundred dollars for people. It all depends how many people end up filing a claim and how many are eligible. But yeah, I mean, it's really interesting too, because a lot of other companies are watching this. You know, Facebook, I had an expert tell me that Facebook is kind of like the canary in the coal mine for privacy issues, because they're the biggest and so much of their business model is built on user information. So there are a lot of other companies, tech and otherwise, that I think are watching this and kind of saying, okay, wow, if Facebook didn't have the resources or decided that it wasn't worth their resources to play this out in court, then we don't have the resources for that either, you know?
Mm-hmm. And so why Illinois? Why do we seem to be more on top of this particular topic than other states?
Yeah, that's a good question. The law dates back to 2008. I'm not sure exactly how it came into play here, but I do know that one of the things that sets it apart, and there's only really a few states that have laws protecting biometric data at all, but what sets Illinois apart specifically is that actual consumers can sue companies or entities that take their information. And what it is that if you're going to take someone's biometric information, you're required by this law to tell them you're taking it, tell them how you're going to use it, and how long you're going to store it. There was another lawsuit, for example, involving Six Flags, because they started using fingerprint scans and for members. And so that was an issue, you know. So, it's really interesting to see. And there's a lot of things that have happened here. For example, I don't know if you remember a couple years ago, Google rolled out that app where you could see if your face looked like a famous piece of art. And it was kind of sweeping social media. Well, they didn't roll it out in Illinois because they were, you know, because it could have potentially violated this law.
I remember that. And so I remember people posting to social media saying, oh, I had my cousin in, you know, Pennsylvania do this for me or things like that.
Yeah, right. And for a while, it was kind of like, wait, am I just not doing this right?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But yeah, it was that. And I think it's interesting because that's an example. And there are other examples too. I know for a while, like Nest, the door cam, you know, mm-hmm. the doorbells, there was a feature they didn't have here in Illinois also because of this law too. So it's interesting to see the big tech giants responding to this.
Yeah, that is interesting. Now, what about more overt times when our biometric information is collected. I'm thinking about the clear kiosks that are now in O'Hare, part of a step of screening with TSA and all that. And then things where you very easily surrender your DNA, like DNA tests, things like that, and send it off for ancestry or health reasons, stuff like that. What about those when they're operating in Illinois? Are there any considerations for them that they've had to take?
Well, what I've had lawyers tell me is that, you know, it's sometimes because it's just consent that is necessary with this law, sometimes it's just a matter of working, those companies working with their attorneys to figure out kind of what language is there, what kind of permissions they have to get from the consumer. But it's funny you should bring up the DNA thing, because there's another law that actually just went into effect this year, and I'm not as well versed on that, but you know, with those types of DNA collecting companies having to notify Illinois residents as well. So there's some lawmakers are thinking about this in Springfield, for sure.
That's really interesting, because as I said at the top, I've always thought it was very interesting how European courts from the jump seem to treat biometric data and data privacy so differently than American courts. So it's interesting to see more conversations around this. I know it's a topic I've talked about a ton. I think you and I have talked about it 3 or 4 times. It's just a really, really interesting one. So what could we, you know, I remember the Six Flags case. So interesting you brought that one up too. What other, you know, where else does this reach to that we may not be thinking of that maybe isn't as obvious?
So I think something to think about with this technology and what privacy advocates worry about is that, you know, if you get your credit card information stolen or your social security number or something like that, like maybe not the social security number, with the credit card information, you can just get a new credit card, right? Like it's pretty easy to kind of, it's a hassle, but it's you can get new ones if that information is compromised. But the worry is what happens if your face map is stolen. You can't just get a new face and you can't just get new fingerprints. But I've also talked to experts that say it's hard to know what the far-reaching ramifications of this would be, because we haven't had, you know, a huge blatant issue where this has happened, where there's been some breach like this. I'm sure it has happened, but, you know, it's just not been widespread that we've all heard about it. It's kind of the unknown, I think, that really concerns people for sure.
Yeah, I've been thinking about that too. I think it's going to probably take some, you know, bad actor or some case to set that precedent. I feel bad for whoever that is, because it's probably going to be a nightmare to untangle it, you know, but yeah.
Well, and the other thing too, is that we are getting more and more comfortable with this. It's becoming more and more familiar to us. I think it was the iPhone 10 that rolled out a year or so ago that, you know, you can log in just by kind of looking at your phone. Like that's facial recognition, and Apple stores everything locally on their phone. But that's just one more step toward consumers becoming really comfortable about this and not thinking about what happens when that information is taken. You know, if you think about how we've all used Facebook and social media for the past decade or more, you know, we're just having a reckoning now about what happens with all that data, and do we own it or do the companies own it, and all that. So it's just kind of taking that a step further to another bit of your data.
Yeah, all very interesting stuff, and really provokes, I think, a lot of philosophical questions about the way we use tools and the way our data is stored and just what it all means, really. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate you joining us. Ali Marotti, business reporter at the Chicago Tribune. Thanks for your time today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You bet. All right. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, plenty more to talk about here on 720 WGN. 720 WGN, it's Amy Guth in for John Williams today with you until 3 o'clock. Thanks for being with me today. Always grateful to you for sharing part of your Saturday. So we are joined now by EJ Schultz, who is Assistant Managing Editor at Ad Age. And EJ, I feel like this is our annual conversation, right? Super Bowl weekend, we always talk about the ads. Welcome back.
It's great to be here. It's sort of a tradition.
I know. It's a great tradition. I appreciate it. Well, this year, there's a lot of interesting stuff to talk about. I know in the past few weeks, people have been talking about Mr. Peanut and what's going on there. But some ads had to make some changes shortly after Kobe Bryant's death. Talk to me about what was in those ads.
Sure. The Super Bowl is just such a huge advertising marketing moment. And every year, it seems to be that advertisers are affected by outside events, and this year, quite unexpectedly and tragically, of course, Kobe Bryant died in the helicopter crash about a week ago. And just as a total coincidence, a few brands actually had helicopters in their ads, and they felt that they wanted to edit the scenes out just to not look insensitive to the tragedy. One of those brands was Genesis, which is a luxury car brand owned by Hyundai. They actually have a lighthearted ad. It features Chrissy Teigen and John Legend. You know, I think there was a pretty quick appearance by a helicopter. They had already released the ad, like many advertisers do, but they went back and changed it and took that scene out. So that's one example.
And then there was also one for GM, which is they're bringing the Humvee right. vehicle back. They changed theirs a bit, too, if I understand.
Right. They're bringing back the Hummer. You might remember the old gas-guzzling truck. And they're bringing it back as an electronic vehicle. And they have a scene of LeBron James in their ad. And the original plan was for them to release it early. But out of respect to LeBron, who is obviously close with Kobe, they didn't want to release that ad early. So they just put out just some quick snippets of the ad. They did not include LeBron in those scenes. But they are going to then release, I think, the full ad tomorrow. Mm. But LeBron will be in the final ad. I think they just didn't feel it was right to do it this week.
Yeah, give him a minute there probably for that
right.
one. And then there's some that have not altered their ad, including, as you note in a piece you wrote for Ad Age, Snickers has a helicopter in the ad, but is leaving that.
Yeah, their ad is, I think it's the scene of a, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with, your listeners might, I mean, it's been a campaign that's been going on for a long time. You're not you when you're
right.
hungry.
Right.
Usually they're like, you know, featuring a celebrity who's like sort of off kilter. They take a Snickers bar and they're, everything's great. They're sort of broadening this out to the whole earth this year and basically saying things aren't right in the world right now, so they're sort of feeding the earth a Snickers bar. And I think they were going to do that, or they are doing it, by sort of dropping a big giant Snickers bar down into a hole with a helicopter. They've decided so far not to alter that scene. And then you mentioned the Planters, which was probably one of the more interesting ads even before the Kobe Bryant tragedy. They had run an ad already showing the Mr. Peanut, the mascot, who actually dies in an accident. It's, you know, sort of a light. I mean, we're talking about a fictional mascot here, right? Pretty lighthearted thing. And they had publicly stated, you know, that they're going to actually have Mr. Peanut's funeral in the Super Bowl. Now, of course, Kobe Bryant, you know, that looks suddenly a little bit risky, right? Even if you're trying to be funny. It's just not a great topic to have right now, but they said they're going to go forward with it. And they've though pulled all their social media around it all week. So they're no longer, you know, they had really gone all in on this and sort of had fun with the notion of him dying, you know, a lot of RIP kind of tweets, things like that. They pulled all that off social in the wake of the Bryant tragedy, but they are going to go forward with the funeral ad last we heard.
Yeah, so it sounds like maybe there was probably some quick marketing meetings to kind of retool the campaign and how that was going to go. But yeah, going forward. Yeah, I've seen so many people talking about Mr. Peanut online. I was like, what's happening? What is this?
Right.
The other one I've seen a lot of people tweeting about is this ad that like PETA has said something about with animals that are kneeling.
Right. PETA does this every year, and it's sort of a stunt. They will release something and claim that it was rejected by the NFL or the network. You know, who knows if it really was. A lot of times we're skeptical of this.
Right.
If they actually have, you know, the $5 million, they would actually buy an ad. So they end up getting, you know, the attention of people by – and this is – other brands have done this over the years as well. You know, you make some pretty outrageous ad and push the envelope a little bit and then claim it was rejected and then – you get some Twitter action on it. Maybe a few people would write about it. I mean, you know, it's an attempt for attention.
Yeah, sure. So I feel like in years past, there's been kind of a through line with a lot of advertisers where you can really point to and say, hey, this is the year where they really took on this big cause. You know, I think back of there was, you know, a lot of stuff about intimate partner violence and domestic violence one year there. You know, sometimes it's in responses. I mean, do you feel like there's a through line this year with what you've seen so far in terms of a bigger cause that a lot of ads are kind of giving a nod to?
On the balance, most stuff is lighthearted. I would say probably more than usual this year. There's a lot of brands going for humor. But there are some brands out there doing bigger emotional spots, and one of them is actually the National Football League. They actually came out with their ad during the AFC NFC Championship game. They're sort of taking on the issue of police shootings of black men, which has of course been in the news for the last few years. They feature a former player, Anquan Boldin, who tells a story of his cousin who was gunned down by a police officer, was eventually found guilty of manslaughter. Of course, this happens in the wake of the several years running Colin Kaepernick controversy. So while the NFL is getting some credit for doing this, there's people that are, you know, claiming that it's a little bit of a cynical move. But so far the ad, I mean, it hasn't gotten a ton. I mean, it's already out there. It hasn't. From what I can tell, it's not gotten a ton of backlash yet, but we'll see when 100 million people watch it on Sunday.
Yeah. I feel like Super Bowl ad releases are kind of becoming like holiday stuff moving into the store. You know, like you see Valentine's Day stuff in December. I feel like it gets earlier and earlier every year. I hate to be like that back in my day crotchety person, but like, isn't there some kind of surprise factor and power in just releasing it, like letting it be viewed on Super Bowl Sunday?
I mean, your observation is right. I mean, at our last count at Ad Age, that we've counted 37 ads already released, and that's up from last year at this time. I think there were about 30. So I think the brands, they feel that if they're spending $5 million for 30 seconds of airtime, they're trying to get the most bang for the buck, and they think that they can do that by releasing it a week or two early so that they can, especially these days with Twitter, Facebook, you know, they put them on those social channels. Hopefully they spread. But you're right. I've noticed, you know, we cover this stuff day in and day out, but the average person, I think, still probably hasn't taken the time to view any of these things, right? They may have stumbled across one on their Twitter feed, or maybe their friend passed them an ad to watch that they liked. But I notice that every year, you know, even if an ad's been out a week or two, that people will act surprised. A lot of people haven't seen it, and they'll get most of the reaction on the game day. I mean, television still matters when it comes to the Super Bowl, so.
Yeah.
And then there are brands that are going to hold their ads. They're not going to run.
Yeah, so. There's that. So, yeah. Well, I'm glad you agree with me on that. I felt like I was being like a grumpy old woman about it, but I was like,
no, it's true.
Well, thank you for the validation. I appreciate that. All right. Well, thank you so much, EJ Schultz, Assistant Managing Editor at Ad Age. For those of you who follow me on Twitter, I'm going to tweet out links to all the stuff we talked about after the broadcast. EJ, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Appreciate it. All right. Talk to you soon. Okay. We're going to take a little break, back in just a bit. Plenty more to talk about. I play this guitar. A little more of that Prince halftime performance from the Super Bowl. That was in 2007, we're hearing. We were talking a little bit earlier about Super Bowl halftime shows. Of course, I gave a shout out to Kitten Halftime at the Puppy Bowl, which is a thing. Shout out to everybody watching that.
Yeah, they didn't make the list.
They didn't make the list. No one consulted with me about this list. Rolling Stone never called. Anyway, but there's a lot of interesting stuff in there. But I threw this question out. I asked you to give us a text to 312-981-7200. What are the mashups you wish you could see or wish you could have seen? So we're saying the rules are, has to be at least three. Doesn't matter, living or dead. This is a dream scenario because no one's actually asking us to program this. But what is the unusual mashup that you would love to see that would make just the best Super Bowl halftime show?
Oh, so you want three?
I mean,
artists.
I would take,
because we've got a few texts, but just with in general.
That's
just
fine.
Dreams.
I'll take them. I would love three because then it makes it weirder and harder.
Right. You know? That's true. You have to think harder about that. Well, somebody texted and said Liberace would have been a great halftime show.
Oh, that would be awesome and sparkly.
That would be great.
Okay, good call on that.
I'm surprised that never happened. Although not really.
They
started doing the halftime show maybe after a little bit after Liberace's prime.
That's
correct. I think still could have happened. I don't know.
Could have happened.
A couple of texts said Metallica.
Oh, that would be interesting.
Which has never happened, has it?
I don't think so.
It's not on that list. I didn't see.
Although I kind of feel like maybe it did. We're going to have to do some research on the next break.
Yeah.
But
well,
no,
you got that list in front of you. I think they listed everything, but I don't remember that
taking place. I don't remember Metallica,
place.
But that would be kind of cool. Yeah.
I'm a little surprised that that hasn't happened already. Yeah. Somebody said Elton John, Boy George, and George Michaels.
Wow.
That would be fantastic.
That would be a heck of a show.
That's great.
I'd go to that. I've seen Elton John live. He puts on a good show.
We haven't even mentioned that tomorrow it will be Jennifer Lopez and Shakira, right? Am I right about that?
I think.
we're caught up in the past.
We are all about the nostalgia, Griffin.
Oh, someone just texted and said the Rat Pack.
Oh, that's a good call. That'd be kind of cool.
Why not?
Why not? I bet I know who that was.
Oh, really?
They texted that.
Christina Aguilera and Britney Spears. That's also a little surprising that something like that didn't happen, because around the time that they started doing these, I think that when these mashups that you're talking about were more popular, we're like at the peak of Britney and Christina Aguilera's powers. And they both, I think, contributed to separate
Super Bowls, I was going to say, I think Christina Aguilera
never together
contributed to the Maroon 5 one.
Right.
I think.
Mm.
Look, I'm no authority on Super Bowl halftime shows.
We're just kicking it around here.
And I'm also not an authority on Christina Aguilera, but I think that is what occurred.
I like that idea, though. And somebody said Beatles, Rolling Stones, and Queen. Well, yeah,
wow.
Of course. Yeah, why not?
God, that'd be
unfortunately,
awesome.
But here's the thing. If you go that big with that many great artists, then 10 minutes or 15 minutes is going to be unsatisfying. It's almost like you don't want to blow your wattage.
Because then
you're like, well, I just want to see them play for like 6 hours, not 20 minutes.
That's right. That's so, exactly right. Okay, so who would yours be?
That's sort of the mitigating thing here. I don't know. I need another hour. I still need the rest
I know. I was thinking about this earlier on all the breaks. I've been thinking about it, and I started kind of a list, and I was like, no. As soon as I wrote something down, I'd think of something else.
And I'm thinking...
See, I know you, and I'm betting that you try to.
You're mixing genres. Well, I want to, of course, but I want to balance like something for me personally.
That's right.
But I don't want it to be too insular or too small. I want it to have a broad appeal too, but somewhere in the middle. I'm not prepared to. I don't have a definite. You haven't said anybody either. Who do you have?
I mean, I think Wu-Tang would be fun. That would never happen, because there's nothing arable. There's not a single arable lyric that the Wu-Tang Clan has ever done.
Yeah, I guess you have to take that into account, too. Because I remember when Madonna had Nicki Minaj and M.I.A.,
and I was like,
we should keep... Honestly, just Nicki and M.I.A. would have been a great show, except for that problem. And M.I.A. did get in trouble.
That's right,
Even her limited thing for what she gave the finger to the camera, I believe.
That's right, yeah, that's
right.
Oh,
brother.
Right. And then, I mean, I got to say, on this list... The Janet Jackson, Justin Timberlake, Kid Rock, Jessica Simpson, Nelly, like all that one, right? Like that's on there, but that's number 20. That was a controversial one. Anyway, plenty more time to talk about this. Back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. 720 WGN, Amy Guth in for John Williams today. Thanks for being with us. Appreciate you sharing your Saturday. We're joined now by Lolly Boeing, who is a writer and reporter at Chicago Tribune, who wrote recently about the plans to manage the housing around the Obama Presidential Center and the pretty complicated debate about how to transform a community. Lolly, welcome to the program. Thanks so much for being with me today.
Oh, thank you for having me. I appreciate this opportunity.
Certainly. Always a pleasure to talk with you. Well, talk us through this story. I think it's a really, really interesting one. There's been so much conversation around the Obama Presidential Center, what it means for that area, and a lot of factors going into this conversation. Talk me through, if you would.
Oh, absolutely. So this story centers around specifically the housing. There's been a lot of conversation over the years about how this development is going to impact the property tax base, how it's going to impact property values, and how it will ultimately impact the cost of living in this area, the cost of renting an apartment, for example, in a neighborhood like Hyde Park, Woodlawn, South Shore, or Washington Park. And those are the neighborhoods that kind of surround the site of the Obama Presidential Center. And so what this story attempts to unpack is the tension between property owners who want to see their property value increase, who want to see a bigger investment in this neighborhood, some property owners and longtime residents who are stable and secure, who have been there for a long time and want to see this area finally grow and develop and kind of counter some Northside communities, versus the constituency of lower income residents who have lived there for equally long periods of time, who worry that now that the neighborhood is going to change. They'll be priced out and displaced. And so they want some guarantees, some ironclad contracts that will firmly affirm that they can stay in this neighborhood as it improves and gets better.
And as community conversations have been happening, this took new urgency recently when Mayor Lightfoot announced that there's a series of ordinances that are coming up, even though no one really knows exactly what's in those ordinances just yet.
Yes. So the city has been having private and closed door conversations with community residents for some time over 2019, since Lori Lightfoot got into office, and trying to understand some of the desires and needs of the community, and trying to figure out how they can both protect the residents that live there, but also invest in a way that attracts new growth and new thriving and abundant residents there. So the culmination of this conversation came last month when the city announced that they would be introducing some legislation that they think will satisfy the goals of both the activists and the longtime homeowners there. But the city has not unveiled those ordinances, so we haven't had a chance to actually look at them. And so they had an open house this past week where they kind of rolled out to the community, just more in conversation form, the desires of their ordinance package and what they're hoping to attain using some laws and using their power in an effort to protect housing and ensure growth.
So in the story that you wrote, and for those of you who follow me on Twitter, I'm going to be sure and tweet this out after the program so that you can read it for yourself, because I think it's really important. It's a really important piece. But as you started talking to residents, what are some of the first themes that came up?
Well, I think it was very complicated, Amy. So, you know, for some residents, there is a sort of residual trauma because they have already been displaced. They've already relocated to this community from other neighborhoods that they have felt priced out of. But then you, on the flip side, you have residents who have come to this community, invested, they've bought houses or they bought condos, and they are frustrated with not having adequate grocery stores or not having a beautiful park or not having the amenities close by that they would desire. And so they want to see their community develop in much the way the West Loop Fulton Market area did. And so it's kind of brought to the surface a tension between the two factions in this community. Those who are very eager and anxious to see it develop and attract a new tax base and a new sort of set of homeowners, and those who say, hey, I've already moved. I've already had to relocate. I don't want to have to move again. I want to be able to stay here and enjoy these amenities, too, for the price that I pay now. Mm-hmm.
And when you move to thinking about the developer stake in this and where, you know, all the different stakeholders, right? We have activists, we have residents, we have the city, we have developers, we have all these different stakeholders in this piece and plenty more that I probably didn't just name. But one issue that came up was around job creation and how developers could help themselves and work with the community.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So one of the residents that I talked to emphasized that if this neighborhood does redevelop, that if investors come and start to construct new buildings or new homes or start investing in retail, for example, or putting office buildings in this neighborhood, that if they promise and guarantee jobs to the residents, then that would give a lower income residents a pathway towards stability. But on the flip side, again, I also talked to residents who said, I'm a senior, I'm 65 years old, or I'm 75 years old, and I'm not looking to start working. I've moved to a community where I could afford to live on my limited income, and now that community is being threatened to be taken away from me. So again, it becomes a really sort of complicated terrain to navigate.
Yeah, indeed it does. I read this story with a lot of interest. I've been following this and many of the factors around it for a while, and I think it's very, very interesting. What, in your reporting of this story and the issues around it, what has been maybe most surprising or something that's really just kind of stuck with you that maybe you didn't expect to find?
Oh, gosh, that's such a wonderful question, Amy. I think that what people need to know is that, again, this conversation has been taking place for years, and it opens up a window into just how complicated this issue is when you talk about trying to invest into a community or redevelop a community, but also protect the residents that are there. Sometimes I think that we reach for the most simplistic answer. Oh, just put a grocery store or just put a major housing complex. But when you really start to peel back the layers and talk to residents, you realize just how complicated it is. And that all of this is taking place, this entire conversation is taking place in the shadows of residents already feeling displaced to this community, or many residents feeling that this is where they landed because they weren't able to afford other communities that were more established, and not wanting to have to go to another low-income community. So I think there's just so much that has to be weighed in this conversation.
Yeah, it's really reminding me of the very recent story talking about aldermen looking for solutions for residents on the western edge of the 606. This was just a couple of weeks ago. We were having this conversation about so many of the same themes of residents saying, "Hey, I moved here because it was something I could afford, and I've lived here. You raise my rent a couple hundred bucks, I got to move again." And very, very real issues for residents. So I appreciate you. Thank you so much, Lolly Bouin, writer and reporter at Chicago Tribune. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you. I appreciate it, Amy.
Have a good one. All right, we're going to take a little break. Back in just a bit here on 720 WGN.
I got angels running away. I got demons hunting me. I know Pop with 25. I know Jesus 33. I tell death to keep a distance.
720 WGN. It's Amy Guth in for John Williams today. Thanks for being with us. Appreciate you. We are joined now by Lior Galil, who is the music writer at Chicago Reader. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Hello. I'm so happy to finally be talking with you on the air. I feel like we've been trying to make this work a long time.
Yeah. Work keeps me busy.
That's right. Well, indeed. Okay, so you have recently taken this wonderful thing. Okay, you have made a list of the best Chicago albums of the last 10 years. Let me start by saying, bless you, because I would not want that task. That sounds like a very, very overwhelming task. So before we even get to the list, where did you start with that? How did you start with that?
I mean, the idea was I knew that there would be a lot of decade in review best album lists coming up, and they wouldn't necessarily reflect what it meant to be in a city with a really vibrant collection of music communities that overlap in really interesting ways and reflect a lot of what goes on here, you know, politically, socially. Like, there's so much that gets lost in translation in these big lists. And I wanted to offer a way for people to engage with what's happening musically in this city in a way that they wouldn't necessarily see in a big list. And they might not necessarily see if they're not paying attention to what's happening in the scene, and, you know, reading what's happening in our community in the many, many places that cover all this music.
Right. And I think you've exactly hit on the thing that kind of filled me with dread when I thought about what would it take to put together this list. And that is, there is so much happening that even just as a fan, keeping on top of it, even, you know, regular readers of all the music publications and all the music writers here in the city, it's a lot to keep track of.
Absolutely. And part of the joy of, you know, putting this whole project together was seeing what people whose work in terms of documenting what's happening in the scene on the ground, what they really admired from the past decade and what they were willing to argue for including in this. We thought of this less of like a hierarchical project, even though there is like a numerical ranking. We thought of this as more of a collection of albums that people care about. And obviously you got to have a cutoff there. So we reached out to more than 100 people in the city who we knew care about music in the city and can say something interesting and offer a different perspective that broadened our understanding of what Chicago music is and can be, to just say what their top 10 favorite albums were, yeah. Which was a huge test for each person. I mean, personally, it was really tough to whittle that down to just 10, but you know, you gotta draw the line somewhere. We weren't going to be able to publish like thousands of albums, although that would have been great.
I would say that would be kind of awesome if you did. If you did, I think a lot of people would be very curious in that, about that list. So you mentioned how interwoven issues become with music here. I think that might be universal, but especially here, I feel like we tend to really lean on our artists to make a statement about social issues. Are there any particular issues that you saw come up again and again in music that was mentioned?
Okay. I mean, hip hop has been such a huge thing in Chicago for a while, but this past decade is when it really showed how much of a part of living in this city it is and how much of it reflects that. And I think all music is political. You are expressing something. You are expressing something human. And often that is saying something from a perspective that isn't necessarily part of the mainstream culture. And that is a political stance. But yeah, there's several rappers who talk about what it means to be a person of color in a city that is hyper-segregated, that when you're a young black person in this city, what it means to see somebody who looks like you get killed, what it means to go to their funeral, what it means to see somebody who you care about die. In the case of Acid Rap by Chance, his breakout mixtape, a lot of that is inspired by, you know, Rodney Kiley's Jr. in front of his, who we saw stabbed to death at a party in Lincoln Park.
Yeah.
Like that, there is a lot of like big P politics that is behind that. But I think what makes a lot of the music that is quote unquote political that's on this list great is that it feels less like it is on a platform that it is trying to preach to, and more that it is engaging with a listener in a real personal way.
Yeah. And something that you pointed out in the introduction that you wrote for this list in the Chicago Reader that I thought was a really great point. What's great about these decade-long retrospective kind of lists is that it can reintroduce music to people that might have missed it the first time around, which I think is such a good point.
Exactly. And I mean, I write about music full time, and I know how hard it is to get people to pay attention to what's going on any day of the week, you know, especially now there's just so much going on for other people to worry about that when it comes to, you know, it's the end of the day and you're looking for something to quote unquote entertain you. If that's how you prefer to listen to music, you are not necessarily going to seek out something that's unfamiliar. You're going to go with something that's comforting. And these lists, while I have my own complaints about lists in general, are a great way to introduce people to unfamiliar music.
Definitely. All right. Well, so there's two lists I want to talk about. There's the Reader top 10, but then your personal one. I want to compare and contrast the two, but let's start with the one, what you ended up with as the top 10 for the Reader.
Sure. I think part of what's really exciting about this was to see what ended up on there, because there were some obvious ones. I think the top five or six albums were going to where I ended up being what I thought they would be, not in the order that I necessarily thought they would be, but it's Saba, who, you know, we heard a song of his earlier. It's No Name, it's Chance the Rapper, Kanye, DJ Rashad, which I knew would be high up, but I didn't expect necessarily to be in the top five, but that's really cool. And then you got Chief Keef, two Jamila Woods albums, another Chance the Rapper album. But the top 10 album is a two-way tie between Nnamdi Ogbonnaya, who is a really fascinating musician who, again, if you talk about Chicago and the way that music scenes overlap and crisscross, he is involved in so many different, really fascinating musical communities. He grew up in the punk scene in the South suburbs. And here on this album, he's rapping, he's singing, he's doing a little bit of everything. And it doesn't feel like it's confined by any idea of what music is and should be. And that album is tied with a record by a hardcore band called Chew, which is just furious and fast and not something I expected to be in, you know, a quote unquote top 10.
But nonetheless, here we are. Also interesting that there's two artists that appear twice in that. And that kind of speaks to, I think, a good deal of loyalty from Chicago music lovers.
Yeah. And also just the kind of the level that like Jamila and Chance have reached. We didn't know what part of what was interesting was seeing what albums there was going to be a lot of overlap with. Mm-hmm. We didn't know that there, you know, what there would be. I kind of assumed there would be with some of the more popular artists, and we were right. But it was really cool to see that there wasn't a lot of overlap in a lot of ways. We had 57 people list their top 10 albums, and we had 338 albums.
Oh my
that
God.
Is a lot.
That is a lot. Yeah, I kind of feel like you could release that list online somewhere, and that would be kind of, people would be interested in that. I would be interested in that. I would retweet you for
maybe,
sure.
I think we've tapped out on our ability to do this for a little while.
Yeah, probably so.
This has been in the works. Yeah, it's been in the works since I came up with the idea or formally pitched it in October, and we emailed people in November to contribute to this. It's been in the works for a while.
That's a pretty fast turnaround. Even then, I feel like I would have needed a year just to get all that organized and all that done. Okay,
yeah.
So let's shift to your personal list. There's some overlap with the reader list, but plenty of other things too. Talk me through.
Yeah. I mean, some of my top two albums, Acid Rap by Chance the Rapper and Care for Me by Saba, were in the top three. Part of that I expected. Again, it was really cool to see where there was kind of the most overlap, and that was in the top album, quote unquote, was Care for Me by Saba. And then my third favorite is Sunday School by Tree, who is a fantastic rapper producer. He just makes these like really fascinating, unstable collages built out of soul samples that are scrambled and sped up sometimes. And it sounds like the songs could fall apart at any moment, but he holds it together. And he has a really captivating, gritty voice. And he has this like weariness in his voice that suggests he's seen everything. But he's just like a masterful storyteller.
That's a beautiful description. I love that. Like the songs could fall apart, but he holds them together. That is a great, great, great way to say that about that album in particular. Awesome. Okay, what else is on the list?
No Name's Telephone, which is also in the top 10. Jamila Woods' Heaven, which is in the top 10. Those are both their, you know, solo debuts. And they both have continued to make really fascinating work. I think part of the reason I just listed those is that I clung to them so much when they first came out. Mm-hmm. I didn't stop playing them that entire year that they released those records. They both came out in 2016. And then right after that is DJ Rashad's Double Cup, again, the number five album that, you know, in the overall vote. And that is a monumental footwork album that really kind of pushed footwork into a pop-friendly format. It is so hard and heavy still, but there are these really beautiful light moments that make it sound like angelic, basically. It's something that dancers can still battle to, but really, I can imagine it on pop radio, you know, whatever pop radio is these days.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, we are running out of time. So for those of you who follow me on social media, I'm going to be sure and tweet all of this out so you can see it for yourself, so you can follow up and find all these artists and all these albums because they're all so good and so thoughtfully chosen. Thank you so much, Lior Galil, music writer at Chicago Reader. Appreciate your time. We got to have you back another time.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Thanks so much. All right, back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. 720 WGN, it's Amy Guth in for John Williams. Thanks for being with me today. Appreciate you sharing part of your weekend. We're joined now by Liz Wessel, who is the owner of Green Concierge Travel, here to talk with us about food trails, which is exactly what it sounds like, and it sounds super fun. It is a program that allows guides to tell the story of a region through its food, which I am totally, totally on board with. Liz, welcome to the program.
Hi, Amy. Good afternoon.
Well, thanks so much for being with us. Well, talk to me about this. I think this is such an interesting idea, and I feel like I've probably subconsciously just kind of gravitated to doing that anyway when I travel, or at least always kind of wanted to do more of that. So where, kind of talk to me about the origin of this and what all it entails.
Sure. And I think it's the starting point is thinking about trails, and trails and tourism and how, we've always had trails that kind of tell a story about an area. And so you can think here in the United States, we've had the historic trails, Trail of Tears, Lewis and Clark National Historic Trail. And then people have been really excited in recent years about going back to do things like these religious trails, like the Camino de Santiago, where you're actually walking and experience the land and the experience of a pilgrimage. And then things started to change, too. And then things happened like the Heritage Trail, the Wild Atlantic Way, where I think you, which is in Ireland, and you really started to get the feel of culture mixed with food, mixed with music. And it's, you know, it's kind of been evolving along those lines. And probably the first big food trails besides that one would have been wine trails, had been around for a while. And one of my favorites, which kind of illustrates the whole link with history, is the Peloponnese in Greece has a wine trail. And if you think about it, they've been doing wine for thousands of years, and they have a huge story to tell about the grapes that were grown there, the people that lived there, ruins, the whole society that was there over history, plus the wine.
That's right.
So now here we are. And the United States, we're beginning to pick this up and really come through with our own food trails around different regions.
Well, and we have them in Chicago, but to me that seems very daunting, simply because there are so many different groups of people that have come through Chicago, made homes in Chicago. I mean, what's wonderful about this city is that you can find just about any kind of food there is, because so many different groups converge here to make this such a wonderful and rich cultural city. What does that look like in Chicago for a food tour?
Well, you know, I actually had the experience of taking a food tour with the guides. They're chefs. They're all chefs. It's chef-driven food tours. And I think what they did was they broke the city down by region and area, because it makes it easier to manage. And a lot of cities, I think, have multicultural stories to tell. And a lot of foods originate in different cities as well. And the food tour I took was such a great cross-section, because we went to the south side and we did soul food down on the south side at Pearl's Place. Mm-hmm. And then we went and we tasted, and by the way, this food tour, I there was way too much food for me, so we ate a lot. But then we went to a place where they did sausages, and then the Polish sausage, and then they went to the beef Italian neighborhood, and we had Italian beef, but then we also had the shaved ice as well. And so they were giving us, you know, multicultural experiences just in that little couple-hour tour. And then you might do something probably for Asian food as well, the Chinese Chinatowns in different places. I think that's the only way you can do it with a big city like Chicago or San Francisco, where there's so many cultures. And luckily, those tour guides are there for you. So you can do the work, or you can just grab onto one of the tours and go.
Right, right. I mean, I think that's the fun part, too. If you're willing to put in the time to organize something, you can do a lot of this yourself and kind of put together, okay, I want to find the greatest, I don't know, Italian beef in Chicago. I want to run around and try a bunch of them. That's a very doable thing now.
Yes, it is. And I must say, the fun tour I put together for Greencast Years Travel was, I grew up in the Bay Area, San Francisco, and I went to a variety of places that I really loved, and I decided that I would put together a small itinerary combining things like the San Francisco Farmers Market, which is amazing down on the waterfront, with the farms and dairy that's going on in Marin County, and the wine that's right next door and in Marin County in Napa, and that whole experience. And along with that is the history. So Point Reyes area, which is a national park, not a national park, but a national seashore, that's where people settled. And the dairy came in because people settled in there with cows. And you wouldn't normally have thought of that, but there they were. And now beef is a big part of that area, as well as dairy. So it was really fun to put together.
Yeah, I bet. That's so interesting. And to me, this kind of speaks to a bigger thing of how much social media is shaping the travel industry. I've talked with some travel writers about this topic before, but you, I'm sure, have a very different perspective on this, that more and more, this seems like a very doable thing. I mean, even, I don't know, just maybe a decade or so ago, to go to wine country was a more of a luxury thing that was a little more out of reach, but now it seems very, most people know someone who's done that if they haven't done that themselves. So this seems like it's getting to be a bigger and bigger part of people's travel itinerary.
Yeah, and I actually want to speak to two things about that. One, there's been a little bit of negative backlash. So the negative backlash is because social media is so instant and people can instantly say, hey, I'm at this place, great cheese, whatever it is, come and see it. Some of these smaller places get overwhelmed very quickly. So that can be a problem when that happens, when a small person, I mean, I can't say that they don't like the business, but it has happened to people that they've been way overwhelmed
than
they can handle.
It's like the Groupon effect, right? A small business gets a Groupon to get going, but then suddenly they got more orders than they can deal with. It's like that. Absolutely. That makes perfect sense. Like, oh no, there's an influencer.
Loving destinations to death, you know, that's where too many of us descend at once and it just doesn't happen. But the good news, this is the really positive news, and I was just reading an article about this, that our connectedness can serve to really spread things out, and these trails help to spread people out along a particular, journey exploring food, and so it can help to spread people out. And the other thing is for interpretation. A lot of what's so exciting is the telling of the story, and people have begun to use online interpretation to give you that instant storytelling. So you arrive at a spot and then you can click into an app. And they'll tell you, like, why is Rouge et Noir on this cheese tour in Marin County? You know, that kind of thing. That it all comes instantly to you. So the storytelling is much, much better now.
Yeah, those are a lot of good points. I think, I agree with you. Sometimes it's easy to lump a lot of change into this thing happened because of social media. I think it's always a lot more complex and a lot more subtle than that. Very, very interesting. Well, so you are based in Madison, Wisconsin. That's where Green Concierge Travel is based on. What would be on your perfect tour of, if you were going to do a food tour of Wisconsin?
A food tour of Wisconsin. Well, I would probably include, obviously, some beverages and probably some farm to table, and I probably might want to do a farmer's market and a U-Pick or something along those lines. So one of the places that I can say right away that I think is a really interesting place to go, they have good food, but is part of the brewing history of the region is the Potosi Brewery out in Potosi, and it has the museum for brewing in its building, and it's in a historic building that was reconstructed. Great beer, good food, and it's on, out near the Mississippi, so it's a great destination out there. So that would be one location I would put on a tour. The other one that comes to mind is Campo di Bella, which is a farm, a working farm, just south of Mount Horeb, and they do these fun community dinners. And a lot of the food comes from their farm, or it's locally sourced immediately after. And most of the dinners are communal, but they do have romantic dinners where you can actually reserve a table. And it's a very small but beautiful location on a hilltop and with beautiful views off, into the setting sun. And you go and you can sit and you meet other people, and they also serve their own wines there as well as others. So they have a little bar in there. And they have a bed and breakfast, so you can stay if you would like. So that would be another destination because it's that true farmer experience where they're actually cooking right up for you.
Yeah, so, and look at that. All of those things, and people think Wisconsin's all about cheese. No, no, no. So much more to do. So much more. Where can
and
people...
you would be remiss if you didn't put the Dane County Farmers Market on your list as well, because that's just
Yeah.
And a total food experience.
Maybe. I'm sure there's people texting the our text line right now going, what about Mars Cheese Castle? Fair enough. We'll hit that on the way up there for sure. Fair enough. You got to always make a stop there. All right. Well, where can people go to find out more about Green Concierge Travel?
They can go to the website, www.greenconciergetravel.com. And I also have a Facebook page, or just get in touch.
Great. Sounds good. All right. Well, for those of you who follow me on Twitter, I'm going to tweet out the link to that website as soon as we are wrapped up here later today. Thanks so much. I appreciate your time. Liz Wessel, owner of Green Concierge Travel. Thanks for your time and insight.
Thank you, Amy.
You bet. All right. We're going to take a little break. Back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. 720 WGN. It's Amy Goof. You're hearing a little bit of U2 playing the Super Bowl halftime show. I jumped right in there. Griffin had a wonderful plan. I jumped right in and talked over it, but it's great.
No,
let's hear a minute. It's good. Griffin, do you agree with the assessment that that was the greatest Super Bowl halftime show ever? This is according
actually,
to Rolling Stone.
Yeah, I just found it again on YouTube. I haven't watched the whole thing back yet. I would like to keep watching. Like I said before, I always had Prince in mind as the best, but
yeah.
I haven't looked at these closely. And just pulling this up just to play it just now, it is an ecstatic feeling, I have to say. This was right after 9/11. This is the 2002.
Right.
So a few months, or I guess maybe like 4 or 5 months after 9/11.
Yeah.
And I don't know. There was an energy around this performance.
That's
People
right.
were freaking out. So I kind of get it, but I'd have to watch the whole thing.
A friend of mine is easily one of the greatest U2 fans in the entire universe, and I will go head-to-head on anybody with that who would like to prove me otherwise. So we're just going to call that fact-checked. She was so emotional. I remember so clearly. I watched that Super Bowl with her, and she was so emotional about that. She was, it was,
yeah.
You know, I think, as you said, 9/11 still kind of fresh in our minds. There was a lot going on.
Well, and to be clear, they'd had a tribute component.
That's right. There was the tribute component. So it was like an emotionally triggering thing, even for people who weren't necessarily very connected to U2. But then to like watch a U2 fan watch it was kind of spectacular.
Yeah, that's nice. That's great.
Yeah. So
I love it.
I think that's fair. There was a lot of energy around that one. Okay. I've been asking for some text messages. What is your ideal Super Bowl halftime mashup of people or just overall performer? Griffin and I have been trying to work on our list throughout the show. I've got mine down to 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, but I think I can cut it in half.
Well, I have like a few things floating around in my head, like what's a person for me personally.
That's what I'm doing too.
But then I also have one that I think is kind of feasible.
Okay.
Like could actually work. Let me throw that at you right now. So what do you think of this? Frank Ocean.
Oh, that's good.
With John Mayer.
Huh. Interesting.
And then maybe one other additional person that I can't think of yet, maybe like the Grateful Dead or something, because I'm trying to connect them. And the thing is, John Mayer appeared on Frank Ocean's first album.
Mm-hmm.
And when Frank Ocean was first on SNL, John Mayer was there too. And I don't think Frank Ocean is quite a big enough star. I mean, in certain circles, he's
yeah.
like the biggest star in the world.
Sure.
But generally,
like your circle
in my brain,
in your realm,
but more generally, maybe not quite
okay.
up to you know Jennifer Lopez or
yeah.
Shakira standards of fame to hold that stage. John Mayer isn't quite either, at least now,
that's right.
But together, and they might be able to amass a weird sort of collection of their hits together,
yeah.
And it's only 15 minutes, I think that might. I think I'm onto something.
I think
it might be really cool.
See, here's what I keep trying to do. I keep trying to go, what would be the, what three things don't match? Let's make that cool.
Right. And I'm trying to like, no, they know each other. So it works this way.
Right. Like,
but you're all about the Clash. Just
yeah.
Getting,
I'm like,
yeah.
Sometimes we proved this out with the Aerosmith Run DMC mashup that
right.
lives on forever, right?
Yes, like, they just did it again at the Grammys.
They just did it again at the Grammys. Exactly. And I was reminded, wow, that actually, you know what? For as much as we've heard that and heard that and heard that, it still works. Okay.
Right. All right, let's hear it.
Here's what I think I've come up with. These are three things that do not match, and so therefore it would be awesome. Okay, right. Here's my lineup.
Yeah.
Wu-Tang Clan, Dolly Parton, and Baroness.
Baroness.
Yeah.
I have to think about who that is.
Think of the song like Take My Bones Away. It's a heavier, I'm not going to say heavy metal, but like a heavier alt rock with Dolly Parton, who is the queen of everything in the entire universe, and she can do no wrong. With Wu-Tang, who also...
Okay, it's coming to me now.
Who Baroness. Also... I don't know if you can play any Baroness on the air.
No, it's not going to happen.
You could probably play the very beginning of Take My Bones Away.
Next time, maybe.
Because it's... I think there might be swearing that you can't make out.
I think you're on to something. I mean, with Dolly Parton, for sure.
Imagine Dolly and Wu-Tang. That would be so cool.
That and they're both beloved outside of their music, too. They're just known entities that
That's
are
right.
like, beloved by everyone.
That's right.
They have a magnanimous spirit in the similar
Absolutely.
Way.
Absolutely. I can
Even though their music is very different, totally they different. Have a similar energy to me.
Although yeah. I would like to propose a mashup that I bet would work well if you took the song Jolene by Dolly and Cream by Wu-Tang.
Yeah. Oh,
think of the
gosh.
Beginnings of both of those songs. They have this kind of pretty, floaty, dreamy kind of quality to them. It would work.
This is.
I just made $1 million as a music producer.
This is high risk, high reward.
This is really high risk.
But very high reward, too. If it yeah. worked, it would be.
Let me tell you about who else was on my list of runner-up people, right?
Okay.
Tori Amos, David Bowie, Snoop, The Police, Elvis, The Smiths, and then just to throw in, like, local cool band that I love and can listen to nonstop, The Growlers.
So, okay. That's all in one?
No.
Just in general,
I was just, like, making a list of, like, how could that work? But then I ultimately decided, like, like, Wu-Tang and The Smiths, I could actually kind of see that working.
You think Wu-Tang works with anybody, is what
Wu-Tang does work with anything.
I think you're onto something. Again, I think that's true.
Say it with me. Wu-Tang always works. It always works.
You no, that's a really good point. Somebody said Tom Petty with Elvis's band or Elvis with
that.
Tom Petty's band.
I could see that totally working with Dolly Parton and Wu-Tang.
Absolutely. We're kind of leaving out the living or dead portion because that just opens up to so much. I couldn't get it out of my head. I'm thinking like feasible options, even though technically the assignment was anybody is fair game. What came to mind is I was thinking about tomorrow, Jennifer Lopez, if she performs the song I'm Real, does Ja Rule appear?
Oh, that'd be cool.
And then, well, it kind of would, but it's not really worthy of the stage in the same way that she is. But as someone who loved that song in its original form, that would be great. And then I was thinking, with the Ja Rule thing, what if we brought the people together who were supposed to perform at Fyre Festival? Ja Rule's
That's
failed.
Hilarious.
If you don't remember, that was his failed music festival that like almost got people killed on an island.
Yeah, like, it was criminal charges resulted.
But Major Lazer and Blink 182 were supposed to perform.
That's right.
Along with Migos. Now it's a little dated because it was a few years ago.
Forgot about Major Lazer.
But I just think some form of those headliners giving the performances they never got to give at Fyre Festival.
That's right.
Something about that idea cracked me up.
I also think it would be kind of funny and weird to do something that would just never work in that like arena big setting of just really obscure bands that are so chill and quiet that would just never.
So we get to my personal. I was thinking about Sufjan Stevens.
Yes.
Who is not very famous to the greater world, but very famous to some people, and can fill a huge. He has big music,
for sure,
anthemic music.
Yeah.
If there was ever a Super Bowl at Soldier Field and he performed songs from his Illinois themed album,
totally,
I would love that.
That would be great.
Someone texted Huey Lewis and Metallica. Now that's another direction that you could absolutely go.
That's another direction. Maybe the.
Do you think they would fit though, Huey Lewis and Metallica?
I have no
Again,
idea.
It's all about
I'm
high risk, high reward.
Up. Right. Okay. I was thinking about the person who texted Metallica earlier. I think an interesting with my clearly I'm going to go for the very complicated high risk, high reward mashup. That might be the direction. Snoop and Metallica.
Yeah, I could see that.
You know, that would be kind of fun. I could see that working. Snoop also works at just about anything.
Metallica keeps coming up. I actually would keep an eye out for them in years to come.
I could see that happening. And as you said, I'm surprised that hasn't. There must be a good reason for it. Well, good grief. We're already out of time, Griffin. How did that happen? It has been a pleasure. We have got to go to break. We got to get you to news, all that good stuff. Back in a bit here on 720 WGN.